This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This is a special Bits and Pieces episode. Longtime listeners will know that we record episodes on Mondays. In the U.S., some major federal holidays occur on Mondays, and so instead of producing a regular episode, we take the week off to be with family and friends. Now, when we do that, we publish an episode with pre-recorded segments from our hosts, our contributors, and even listeners like you. Due to this week's Memorial Day holiday, we bring you a Bits and Pieces episode. Now, we'll kick it off with our main man, Micah, who tells a story he calls Disaster on Brick Hill, the worst day in Maine aviation history. It's a fitting piece for Memorial Day. Here's Micah.
Disaster on Brick Hill, the worst day in Maine aviation history. In the past, I've talked a little about Veterans Day. Here in the USA, it's a national holiday that takes place on November 11. Originally called Armistice Day and created to celebrate the end of the Great War, World War I, in the USA, it's morphed into a day that celebrates all servicemen and women. Memorial Day is a different holiday and currently falls on the last Monday in May. Up until 1967, it was called Decoration Day, and up until 1970, it always fell on May 30th. It was conceived to celebrate the American Civil War veterans, particularly those of the Union forces. For many years, shortly after the war, on May 30th, many former slaves in the South would visit cemeteries and decorate the graves of the veterans of the Union forces. Eventually, the practice spread nationwide, and it became a time to honor all who died in military service. In 1970, it became a Monday holiday, and is now just another three-day weekend that marks the start of the summer season here in the USA. For this Memorial Day Bits and Pieces episode, as a tribute to the nature of the holiday, I thought I'd take the opportunity to honor a few veterans who lost their lives in air tragedies here in Maine during World War II. As part of that, I thought I'd bring you an interview with a man whose life intertwined with one of those two tragedies. It was the afternoon of July 11, 1944, and a B-17G Flying Fortress was en route from Kearney, Nebraska to Dow Army Airfield in Bangor, Maine. While over the Appalachian Mountains, turbulence somehow affected its compass, and later, the crew lost radio communications. Having been in the air over 12 hours, fuel was getting low. The pilot decided to dip below the clouds to look for landmarks. After an hour of flying in slow circles, the crew figured out they were near Rangeley, Maine, and decided to set down at 8 Bravo Zero, a small airfield that was cleared by 20 men in the Civilian Conservation Corps back in 1934. While in a bank, turning toward this tiny airfield, the left wing of the B-17 clipped a treetop. The bomber broke up as it cartwheeled through the forest of Deer Mountain. All 10 crew members were lost, making it Maine's worst ever aviation disaster. But that was only for a few hours. You see, later that same afternoon, at around 4:45, Second Lieutenant Philip Fee Russell was preparing to land his A-26 Invader at Portland Westbrook Municipal Airport, PWM, and now more commonly referred to as the Portland Jetport. Now, the Douglas A-26 Invader is a confusing aircraft. It entered service with the U.S. Air Force in 1941 and wasn't removed from the inventory until the early 1970s. It's often mixed up with the Martin B-26 Marauder, a completely different airplane that was in service from about 1941 to 1945. They were similar in size, and both were twin-engine aircraft. Each was designed with the same two Pratt & Whitney R2800 double Wasp 18-cylinder radial engines. But the real confusion comes from the Invader's designation as an attack aircraft. In 1947, the newly formed U.S. Air Force decided to abolish the attack category of aircraft, and from 1948 until 1969, the A-26 was redesignated to B-26. But while it was still in the inventory, the Air Force chose to bring back the attack designator, and in 1969, the Invader was redesignated back to the A-26. To this day, confusion reigns when discussing the Martin Marauder and the Douglas Invader. So let's get back to July 11, 1944. Second Lieutenant Philip Fee Russell was an instructor on the A-26. He was a native of South Portland, Maine, based at Barksdale Field in Louisiana. Fee was given special permission to fly what was dubbed a long-distance training mission to his hometown here in Maine to visit his wife and three-month-old daughter. Now let's talk a bit about South Portland back in 1944. The west side of the city was mostly farmland. An area known as Brick Hill is in a portion of the city known as Red Bank, just south of the airport. Back then, it was newly developed government housing that included a large trailer park. Why so much housing in this former farming area? Well, on the east side of South Portland, on Spring Point, about 6 miles away, was a huge wartime shipyard building Liberty ships. Many of the shipyard workers moved to Maine with their families and ended up in cheap government housing on Brick Hill. To this day, it's still a working-class community. So Second Lieutenant Philip Fee Russell was flying his A-26 to South Portland to see his family, meet his wife and new three-month-old daughter, and visit with friends, all of whom were waiting for him at the airport. But that meeting was not to happen, and what his friends and family witnessed was monstrous. But now, it gets confusing. The military accident report says Fee was at about 200 feet, and there was a 500-foot ceiling. It goes on to say that he was disoriented by the fog. An air traffic controller said it was 4:41 in the afternoon and that Fee was 5 minutes ahead of schedule. But that same controller also said the airport had closed due to fog at 4:35. The Portland Press-Herald reported that Fee was told to climb to 1,500 feet when he asked for landing instructions and that the tower was going to reroute him to New Hampshire. Other reports say that the A-26 passed the tower, then circled back to land, and some witnesses said smoke and fire was coming from an engine. All we know for sure is that Second Lieutenant Philip Fee Russell crashed his Douglas A-26 Invader into the trailer park on Brick Hill, setting off a huge blaze. Each of those trailers had a 55-gallon drum of heating oil or kerosene attached to it, which fueled the fire from the crash. Fee and his navigator were killed, as were 17 to 19 people on the ground, and 20 on the ground were seriously injured and burned. The numbers vary, but it still makes for the biggest aviation disaster the state of Maine has ever seen. Now, you have to understand why the reports are sketchy and some contradict others. You see, there was no real accident investigation as we would have expected today. Why is that? Well, it was July 11, 1944, slightly over a month after D-Day. The Army didn't have time to investigate every accident. They were busy with other things. Training accidents happened all the time. It was anticipated. It was the cost of doing business. So why am I telling you this story today? I mean, it took place in 1944. What brought it to my attention? Well, it wasn't until 10 years ago that the city of South Portland decided to put up a memorial to this event. That memorial is just around the corner from an office I visit regularly. While there one day, the person next to me was talking about the memorial, and it turned out he had a personal connection to the incident. He and I struck up a conversation, and I asked if I could interview him. His name is Phil, and he was reluctant to talk about it. He's a quiet and reserved man and wanted no notoriety. He didn't want to even give me his last name, and I agreed. It was obvious this was something very personal to him. I told him a bit about the Airplane Geeks podcast and that I had no sensationalistic interest in this event, that the details would be handled with the deference and dignity they so deserved. Phil said he would think about it, and one day, a couple of weeks later, he said, "Get your mic," which I did. This is the result. Phil, can you tell us a little bit about what happened on July 11th, 1944?
What I learned from my dad, who went to high school with Phil Russell, who was known as Fee. My parents at that time were not married. They were supposed to go out to dinner with Fee Russell and his wife and were waiting at what was then the Portland airport. And Fee crashed. It was, from what my dad said, a foggy, ugly day, and visibility was bad. And as luck would have it, my mother's dad, my grandfather, was a call captain with a volunteer fire department on the other side of South Portland. And his son, who was still in high school, was a volunteer fireman. And they ended up, obviously, on the call because the damage was intense. My uncle told me in his later years that that crash was the reason why he wanted nothing to do with being a fireman. That was his last call.
So as I recall, he was flying from Louisiana to visit his family here in Portland, Maine. And he was coming into Portland Westbrook Municipal Airport at the time. And in the fog, he was told to circle around to come around for a second.
He had made one pass and apparently was attempting his second when the crash occurred. It was temporary housing for workers at the shipyard. There were obviously a lot of families there, women, children, and the time of day it happened. Luckily, it wasn't late at night, but the loss of life was significant, and the burns and they bussed them over because the shipyard was on the east side of the city. It ran 24 hours a day. Some people lived in places here. There were the workers who stayed in people's homes. My grandmother and grandfather had people who lived in the attic or slept in the attic of their home for several months. So it was common back then.
And it was your father was supposed to be going out with him that evening?
Father and mother. They were going out to dinner. They went to high school together, played sports together.
And your grandfather, did he tell you what his experiences were in the rescues?
He never really spoke about it. He died in the 50s, so I never got much of a chance to talk to him about that.
It sounds like it was just a horrible experience for your entire family at the time.
It was. My dad struggled with that, and he was a man who didn't struggle with much.
There is a memorial there now, this beautifully carved stone made from the same granite that actually was used to build the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers down in Washington, D.C. What you go by that almost every day. Does it go through your head as you see it?
You know, I've never read the plaque or anything. I've never stopped there.
Phil, I know this was a difficult interview for you, and I greatly appreciate you taking the time to speak with the Airplane Geeks about it. This is a piece of history that's not very well known, and with all history as important as this, it needs to be preserved. So we really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
So that's the story. Quite intense, isn't it? There's been history in my backyard all the time I've been here in Maine. I'm just happy I was able to learn about it and share it with you. So thank you, Phil. And on this Memorial Day, let's say a prayer for Second Lieutenant Philip Fee Russell, who's been flying west for the past 76 years. For the Airplane Geeks, here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
The death of an aviator touches many lives, and clearly Phil has lifelong memories that resulted from that crash. So thank you, Micah, for capturing the history as well as the effect. Micah also provided the link to a webpage titled Douglas AB-26 Invader Accidents, and you can find that in the show notes. Now we transition from looking at the past to peeking into the future. Benjamin Youngstrom is a recent college graduate and founder of Cirrostratus Airship Company. He has a vision, and he's working to make it a reality. Here's my conversation with Benjamin. I'm speaking with Benjamin Youngstrom. He's the founder of Cirrostratus Airship Company. Benjamin, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we've got you on Skype. Glad we were able to catch up with you. Now, you're a recent college graduate, but you've got an idea or a vision. What is it?
So, actually, it goes back quite a while. I first had this idea in middle school, and it was more of a dream. I always loved blimps of the early 1900s. I love the idea of being able to just hang out in the sky. I've been lucky enough to fly a lot in my life, and it never felt long enough. And so I thought if I could find a way to extend that, to be able to sleep and spend a couple of days in the sky, that would be awesome. And so as I've gotten older, I tried studying aerospace engineering to figure that out. But that didn't work out for me, and I ended up going down the business route. So I ended up bringing on a couple of team members with me to work on this. But we began developing an airship platform with the goal of essentially having a flying yacht, a way to actually stay aloft for a couple of days at a time, to be able to wake up and look out the window and still be in the sky. And so we've been very lucky to build a lot of connections in the industry, meet a lot of great people, and we're actually making a surprising amount of headway on this project for a group of people who are so young. And I guess I'd rather not say inexperienced, but that'd be a decent word for it.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes youth and inexperience, or one or the other, can be a tremendous asset because you're not constrained. Your thinking is not constrained by ideas of others or things that have been tried and haven't worked, and all of that kind of baggage. I think there can be a lot of creative results from someone that isn't, you know, hasn't been in the industry for 30 years, and you know, and all of that. So the idea is an airship that would stay aloft for some period of time. Who do you think are the likely customers of that kind of a service?
Well, there we've got a few sectors that we're looking into. Now, the most obvious and the most exclusive is going to be your billionaires and your UHNIs, or ultra high net worth individuals. Those are people with net worths usually calculated about 30 million over, but the reality is we'd have to target a group of individuals around 500 million in assets or over. We hopefully should be able to retail the platform at about 70 million, give or take, and that would be before options. So it'd cost about as much as a G650. Sadly, that makes it a little exclusive, and the original dream and the ongoing dream is to find a way to make it available for most people to at least experience once. So our hope is also to offer it as a new type of cruise platform. As I'm sure some individuals are aware, Crystal Cruises has their 777, and I believe it's Four Seasons has their A320. So we're hoping to provide a way for the common man to enjoy that dream in the same way that billionaires will be able to enjoy it.
I really like the idea of being able to spend leisure time almost up in the air, not a relatively short period of time that's really designed around getting you from point A to point B quickly. And then on with your business. You know, sometimes people talk about travel, and in travel, they talk about the journey being the objective more than the destination. Sounds kind of like the same thing here.
Absolutely. Every trip I've ever been on, and I've had the very extreme privilege of being able to do a lot of traveling in my life, I tend to enjoy the flight more than being there, much to the chagrin of my family. But that's the best part. I'd rather spend 12 hours in economy class than 30 hours in any city in the world. It's something about looking out the window at the sky passing below you. It's totally different than anything else. I've gone out of my way to be a part of the first flight of a lot of my friends who haven't had the opportunity to fly. It's totally different than what most people get to feel. And I'm sure anybody listening to the podcast understands that.
Yes, of course. Yes, absolutely. Now, you have the benefit of some work that others have done. You're not creating an airship from a clean sheet of paper yourself.
No, we're not. We're actually working with a few companies. We have agreements to gain access to confidential information from a few major players in the industry. Our goal is not to build the airship from the ground up. We are building the gondola platform and we're retrofitting it to a pre-built gondola. Now, we've got a couple companies that we are talking with. I can't go a whole lot deeper into detail about that because of ongoing events that we just don't want to confirm a whole lot of stuff right now. We have the opportunity to speak with units that you usually wouldn't converse with people of our experience and age. So having been able to accomplish that, we are hesitant to really talk about who we're deeply involved in. But what I can say is that our platform is about 3,000 square feet and is retrofittable onto a series of hybrid lifting vehicles from a number of companies in the industry currently.
Right. We've seen and we've talked about a couple of companies working on that kind of a concept, hybrid air vehicles, Lockheed Martin, and so forth. Maybe to review a little bit for our listeners, when we talk about a hybrid airship, maybe explain that a little bit. It's a combination of lift produced by helium as well as the lift generated aerodynamically. Is that right?
It is. Actually, it's a combination of three. It's aerodynamic lift, helium lift, and vectored thrust lift.
Ah.
So what a lot of companies are looking to do is be able to fit their aircraft into small places. And with the standard blended lifting platform, as it was originally conceived by Northrop Grumman in, I believe, the late 80s, needed an airfield. So as they continued to develop that platform, thrust vectoring became an extra little system of lift, mm-hmm. would be the best phrase. And so it uses three lifting bodies, aerodynamic lift, helium, and thrust vectoring.
Now, I've seen some designs address the problem, not the problem, but maybe the issue of docking and mooring. Historically, we've seen things that are attached to a mast or something of that sort. And I've seen some designs that take a really different approach with the gondola having devices or areas that allow you to land right on the ground.
Yeah, that's stuff that we can't talk too in depth about because most of it's patented and NDA'd.
Okay.
It exists. I can go as far as to say it exists and it functions and it's very interesting. A lot of it's kind of just like a large suction cup, as it were. And some of it uses technology along the lines of those large naval hovercrafts just working in reverse.
Yes, right. And so it would allow you to land on the ground, but also almost provide some suction to keep it positioned on the ground. As far as in the air, are these kinds of airships subject to issues with different weather conditions or high winds or things like that?
So like any aircraft, of course, they're subject to high winds and storms. But being such a large platform, what many of them have is some level of variable ballast system, which can handle weather up to an extent. But it can't handle a large load transference. Mm-hmm. So they actually fly equivalent to, if not slightly more stable than a lot of large aircraft. Mm. but there can absolutely be conditions which will throw the balance off on an aircraft like that, which is much more dependent on balance than most conventional jet aircraft, mm-hmm. To where it can overreact against weather. Hmm. So they're a lot more complicated to fly than a standard aircraft, but with the right training and the right piloting, they can be just as smooth, if not more comfortable.
And what kind of destinations or points of departure would you envision? Would this take place at airports or some other kind of facility?
Really, we see anywhere large enough to fit a couple trucks full of ballasting material and the aircraft itself. So tended fields with a space that's about 300 feet long and 150 feet wide.
Hmm. And so you mentioned the gondola size. Did you say 3,000 square feet? Is that what you said?
About 3,000.
About 3,000. And so any thoughts on size of the crew, number of passengers, anything of that sort?
Passengers, we estimate at a maximum 35 individuals. And crew can be as little as two or as large as 35 individuals if someone were to want to be waited on constantly.
Yes. And I imagine for an extended period of time, too. For a long trip, you need multiple meal service and things like that. What's the trip durations that you envision, or is it something that would be just dependent on whatever the customer wants?
It's mostly dependent on what a customer wants. From our understanding of our client, it would last about 3 to 4 days. Hmm. But it truly is technically indefinite. The real range is give or take 2 to 3 days flying at full power. But with an aircraft like that, you can sail. So you can shut off the engines entirely and let currents take you wherever and turn it back on and have it land. So really your only limitations is the food on board.
Hmm, interesting. What sort of engines do you envision? Electric or fuel powered? Or
we're starting with engines that would run off gas, though they are far more efficient than anything currently used on the market. As far as a jet aircraft or a yacht, where this aircraft would compete. So they definitely are a greener option, though they don't exactly fit into the use of a jet aircraft or a yacht. So it's a different platform in itself. Though our goal is, as we continue to develop, to work on green technology and bringing solar power to this field. Sadly, it's just not feasible right now. The weight of a solar panel against the energy produced makes it so that it's non-viable for a lighter-than-air vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the team.
My team was actually put together a little over a year ago, and it was near the end of my college career. I reached out to the ASME at my school, which is the American Society for Mechanical Engineers, and I pitched the project to them. I had already had the opportunity to get to know a few major players in the industry, and I've got a bit of expertise in the aerospace industry, and I have prior experience in the entrepreneurial space. So I decided it was time to finally pursue that dream. So I pitched the project to the ASME, and they loved it. So they got in contact with the dean of the mechanical engineering school, who sent an email that I wrote out to every junior and senior in the school. After that, I held interviews, and I ended up picking three people, Torin Rosenbluh, Matthew DeMond, and Bryce Finley. They've all done major internships with large companies, Daniel Defense, Gulfstream, and Beck Engineering. But all of them have some level of aerospace engineering, and all of them are incredibly smart, far, far smarter than I am. And I'm incredibly blessed to have this team. And as we continue developing, we've brought a few other individuals on board. I luckily don't even have to run our social media. We've got somebody doing that for us. And so we're in the process of growing. And anybody who decides to take a look at our website after this, it needs an update very bad, and we're in the process of updating it. Our goal when we first made it was just to use it as a virtual business card. Mm-hmm. But we've got a guy doing that for us now too. So we're really coming together as a really solid team at this point.
So I'm curious about your interactions with some of these established companies that, as you, I think, alluded to earlier, maybe are not typically predisposed to devoting a lot of energy to, you know, a group of relatively new and young folks. Why are they listening, and how did you get them to listen?
I've been told I'm a great salesman.
That helps.
Essentially, it's just coming in with a game plan. We always know what we want to talk about, what we believe is important about our project, and what we believe will be important to the people we're talking to. I have a lot of people backing me who've have asked to remain unnamed until we reach a couple benchmarks. But we have some very big names behind us, and that's been a massive blessing. And so as we've continued to develop, they've put us in contact with people who are more likely to listen at these organizations. So while none of them have aided us financially, they've aided us in finding people that we should never be able to talk to. Mm-hmm. And that's given us a lot of opportunity to continue forging forward on this project. I can't truly tell you how we gotten this far, but we're light years ahead of where we thought we'd be at this point.
Yeah, it's very impressive. Very, very impressive, actually. What are the next steps? What's sort of immediately ahead for you now?
Well, given the pandemic that's going on, a lot of development slowed. And so we've focused on building awareness for what we're working on. Like I said, we're updating our website. We have a series of interior designs and marketing images that are about to be rolled out. And one very exciting thing is we've actually patented a portable 3D printer. It's a full-size 8x8x8 3D printer that folds entirely down and is mobile. And it was developed for some of the work we're doing right now, but we're about to put it on market as a retail item. So we've got a little branch coming out of what we're working on. And I'm actually very excited because it was the brainchild of one of my engineers, and I'm happy to help him see a dream of his own added to the project we're developing. So that's going to be a small focus while we mostly focus on building media attention and building a name for the project we're developing.
Very good. And we should mention the website. It's the same as the company name, right? CirroStratusAirshipCompany.com, right?
Yes, sir, it is.
Yes, great. So it really feels like you're kind of living the dream right now. this is kind of remarkable. Did you consider going to work for an aerospace corporation, for example, or is this direction you've taken something that's more suited to what you're good at?
I think that this direction is the only direction I could go in. I find myself very comfortable leading projects and chasing my own ideas. And I feel that while it would have been awesome to work for Gulfstream, Dassault, any of those companies, I'd much rather be taking my time and struggling and spending hours every day working on something than going in and out of an office. Don't get me wrong, I'd love an office, but I'd like to be the head of that office.
Yeah.
But I'd rather spend the time working. I love being busy. I'm supposed to be on vacation actually right now, but I've been working through it. I'm up at 5 a.m. and down by 10.
Wow. Very good. All right. Well, Benjamin, this is a really exciting project. It's big. You're thinking big, but you're thinking along the way and managing it as a project. And I particularly like the, you know, the relationships you've made with some of the other companies and with individuals that can offer guidance and support and all of that, because probably without that, you'd be kind of on your own, and it'd be a difficult kind of a project.
It is, and we're very blessed to have made the progress we have and accomplished what we have. And like I said, I gotta honestly give a lot of credit to my team. It's a lot of hard work along the way.
Great. And so just finally, if I were to ask you if you would give advice to, let's say, students who are currently at university, but also kind of thinking about something they would like to do and have a dream or a vision, do you have any advice for those folks?
Be prepared to work incredibly hard. Nothing comes easily. Nothing will be handed to you. I've been blessed to come from a family that's achieved a lot, and I know that's a leg up, but I've seen a lot of people come from nothing and achieve great things by working hard. Finding good people is one of the biggest keys to success, but no matter what you do, it's the work and the people in your life that'll get you where you want to go.
You're very wise for someone that's so young. That's, I love it. I love it a lot. So we'll have a link in the show notes, of course, to the website, cirrostratusairshipcompany.com, if you're driving or something and can't note that down right now. So check out the show notes for that link. And Benjamin Youngstrom, we really appreciate you being able to spend a little bit of time with our audience, and we look forward to following along the progress and just, you know, watching to see where you go. So thanks again.
Of course. It's a pleasure and an honor.
I think it's remarkable that someone just beginning their professional career has such a clear vision and is working very hard to make it a reality. Benjamin is driven, and what he's seeking to achieve is not going to be easy. As Benjamin and I exchanged email before the interview, I told him, I like dreamers. The realization of dreams can be difficult to attain, but if you don't have dreamers, you only get slightly better than nothing. I think that's true. Finally, a late arrival from our reporter-at-large Launchpad Merzari, who's been out flying his Focke-Wulf. First, Launchpad explains what he's been up to, and then we have the ATC recording to prove it.
Making lemonade out of lemons. Okay, the pandemic and the shelter-in-place orders have really hammered the aviation industry. With airline traffic down 80%, that means big hub airports are now handling less than 100 flights rather than a few thousand flights per day. With just a little coordination, there's an opportunity for you to put a Class Bravo airport in your logbook. I called Dallas Approach on the phone, and they told me that between 11:30 and 12:30, there are only 4 scheduled arrivals and departures, and it was the lowest time of their day for them. I told them that I wanted to land just for the fun of putting DFW in my logbook, and that this would be all VFR, and they said no problem. Now, I've been reading online of people who have done this at other airports, and it seems like every major Class Bravo airport has its own rules. Some say you must be on an IFR flight plan. Others say you can only do a touch and go. Others say that you can't do a touch and go and you must do a full stop, then accept a midfield takeoff. No problem, as 4 of the 7 runways at DFW are over 13,000 feet long. I could do 3 full stop landings and then 3 takeoffs and still be on the same runway. Some say as long as you don't pull off the taxiway, you don't own airport fees. I spoke to the FBO, and yes, amazingly, DFW has 100 low lead and an FBO. They told me that based on the weight of my aircraft, ramp fees would only be $20. Well, that's not bad. But then they said, hold on, flyboy. The airport will charge you an additional $75 on top of that. Oh, well, that put it outside my let's do this for fun and giggles range. So I filed a flight plan, fired up the FW. Dallas Approach and DFW Tower were extremely accommodating at the time. I was one of only 4 aircraft inside the inner ring of Class B, but it wasn't until I was handed off to the tower that they were able to confirm that if my wheels touched, I would owe landing fees to the good city of Dallas. So I was cleared to 17 Charlie. Yes, DFW has 5 parallel runways. So I decided to change it to a low approach. It was still exciting to get to legally fly at less than 50 feet for 2.5 miles. So you want to do this yourself. Start by calling the tower and approach center of the big Class B airport you want to do this at and find out when is the best time. What are the best procedures? Full stops only, just touch and goes, low approaches, landing fees, flight plans, get on the taxiway, stay off the taxiway, so on. Make it easy on yourself and everyone else. Get flight following before you enter the Class Bravo airspace. Then they know you're coming. In my case, the controller on the radio happened to be the same controller I coordinated with on the phone the day before. And when he passed me off to the tower, everybody knew what the intent was, and everybody was happy and cooperative, and it was really an easy time. Sorry, no photos, as my co-pilot and I were too busy flying to be screwing around with the GoPro, which had problems just before we entered the Class Bravo airspace. But this is radio, so at the end, I will present the edited audio from liveatc.net. So, pandemic, social distancing, shelter in place have really taken a bite out of us aviators. But let's try and make lemonade out of these lemons they've handed us. Do something we couldn't do in normal times. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
DFW Tower, Bockwolf 9145, 4 miles to the west for a low approach, sir.
Mix 61, have you contact Depot? Good day.
America 61, yes, come on.
November 9145, DFW Tower, wind 16013, gust 22, runway 17 center, clear for the low approach.
Bockwolf 9145, 17 center for low approach. Sir, are you going to call my base for November 9145?
Yeah, I'll call your base. Giant 7163, heavy on at the spare, runway 17 right, clear, take off.
Runway 17 right, clear, take off. Giant 7163, heavy.
Giant 7163, heavy, contact Depot, if you get in.
7163, switching the departure, thank you.
November 9145, in about a half a mile, start your base.
Bockwolf 9145, we'll start our base in half a mile, put us right over the lake. Thanks, sir.
Mix 1331, on out the V-Park, runway 17 right, clear, take off.
RNAP to V-Park, RNAP to V-Park, and clear for takeoff, 17 right, America.
November 9145, turn right, heading 240, maintain 2000.
Heading 240 for Bockwolf 9145.
November 9145, in contact approach on a 135.97.
135.97, and thank you for this adventure, sir.
Hey, you're welcome. Have a good one.
Well, that's it for this Bits and Pieces episode. We hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we'll return to our usual format. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/605. And of course, our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.